Coming up next, we'll hear another in a series of luncheon speakers from the Economic Club of Indiana in downtown Indianapolis. Dr. Stephen Hayward is an authority on environmentalism, economics, and public policy. He starred in An Inconvenient Truth, or Convenient Fiction, last year, a rebuttal to Al Gore's global warming film. His speech, The Unseriousness of Climate Change Policy, Confronting the Economic and Energy Realities, was given April 29th at the Economic Club of Indiana luncheon. Hayward does not deny our world is warming, but questions the positive effects of environmental technologies and wonders if there are real beneficial effects.
This is why I say that most of these technologies simply don't match up to the scale of the energy required or are not cost competitive in their current form. And that's why I say our discourse on this issue is fundamentally unserious.
Dr. Hayward talks to the Economic Club of Indiana. But first, this news.
Broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series is made possible in part by ProLiance Energy. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.
Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. This month's speaker is Dr. Stephen Hayward, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He's an expert on environmentalism, economics, and public policy. Hayward told the club, while he does agree that our Earth is warming, it may not be that dismal of a situation as it is portrayed.
Proposing an alternative view that contradicts mass media pundits and the vocal opinions of celebrities, including a former vice president, is not easy, especially when you're addressing an issue as important as the environment. Stephen F. Hayward says that the Earth is indeed warming, but adds that's not a reason to panic, as some environmentalists suggest. Following his remarks, we will have a question and answer session. If you have a question, and I think some of you will, please fill out the white card provided on your table, bring it to the stage when he's finished speaking, and we'll get it asked. Mr. Hayward studies the environment and politics and public policy as a senior fellow at the Pacific Research Institute. He's also the F.K. Weyerhaeuser Fellow in Law and Economics at the American Enterprise Institute. Each year he writes the Index of Environmental Indicators for the Pacific Research Institute, and that index was released this month. Last year, Hayward challenged the views of global warming activists, including the views of former Vice President Al Gore. Hayward produced and starred in a rebuttal film titled An Inconvenient Truth or a Convenient Fiction. He believes that the language of skeptics versus alarmists has put the whole issue of climate change into a straitjacket, leaving little room for reasonable middle ground. He adds that you shouldn't believe everything you hear reported in the media. Last week, for example, some advocates used the occasion of Earth Day to suggest that the United States is lagging behind in environmental efforts. Hayward's comment, the U.S. remains the world's environmental leader and will likely be so in the future. Hayward's work has been published in newspapers such as the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and the Chicago Tribune. He has also written books on Winston Churchill and former presidents Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter. His speech today is entitled The Unseriousness of Climate Change Policy, Confronting the Economic and Energy Realities. Hayward is sure to offer fresh perspectives on the status of global warming and the environment. Like each of you, I'm looking forward to hearing his remarks. Please join me in welcoming Stephen Hayward.
Well, thank you very much, James, and thank you very much to the Economic Club of Indiana for this kind invitation, and I'm overwhelmed by this turnout for little old me. And there's actually a little element to that little old me. As was suggested, I've been shadowing Al Gore for a while now, and shadowing him for a while in more ways than one. I finally got decided last summer that I had really gotten too fat, decided to lose a lot of weight. So I actually have dropped about 45 pounds in the last 6 months, and I've been trying to sell my calorie offsets to the vice president. Looks like he could use a few. I haven't heard back from him yet, so they're out for bid if you want to buy my calorie offsets. I chose this provocative title, The Unseriousness of Climate Change Policy, some months ago when the invitation from the club first came. And it was out of a moment of exasperation about what I regard as the all-too-easy and cheap talk that climate change is a problem that can be solved with little more than pixie dust and duct tape, or so it seems sometimes by even the recent TV ads that some of you have seen. In recent weeks, there have been a few glimpses of more seriousness about the subject, but there's still something hugely amiss that I'll walk through today. I do want to begin and set the scene by saying it's not my primary purpose here today to rejoin the scientific dispute about the nature and extent of global warming, except to note my objection to the line of argument that the issue is settled or closed, or that those who have doubts about the catastrophic scenario beloved of the former vice president are to be thought of as the moral equivalent of Holocaust deniers or flat earthers. It's never a good sign when someone wants to try and close down disputation with name-calling and intimidation. Those of you out in the room who suffer from insomnia, I encourage you to go onto that famous invention of Vice President Gore's, the Internet, where you can download the entire 900-page report on climate science, the most recent one from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And in those 900 pages, I've read through an awful lot of them because I am something of an insomniac. In those 900 pages, you will see the word uncertain or uncertainty used 1,300 times. And the report itself describes our level of scientific understanding of many key aspects of climate science as either low or very low, which hardly sounds like a matter that's nailed down or fully settled to me. Now, what people commonly call a consensus about global warming is properly described in succinct terms as followed. The Earth has warmed, on average, about 0.8 degrees Celsius over the last century. It's not entirely clear that that is unprecedented. There does appear to be good evidence, though not absolutely ironclad evidence, of a human role in some or most of this. But the real issue is this. For more than 30 years now, computer climate models have predicted that if we double the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, pause here, we're about a third of the way to doubling from pre-industrial levels, and at the current rate, it would take us about another 100 years to double the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That whole subject itself is one you can go on a long time about. Anyway, the models have suggested for 30 years now that if we double the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, global temperature would increase between about 1.5 degrees Celsius on the low side to about 4.5 degrees Celsius on the high side. Now, that's a pretty wide range, and that range matters a lot because warming at the low end of that range would have modest or even benign consequences. Warming at the high end of that range would have serious and expensive consequences. And despite billions of dollars of research and data gathering and ever faster and more complex computer climate models, we haven't been able to narrow that range, nor have we been able to arrive at a very high probability for a best guess within that range. Now, despite the high degree of confidence asserted by the most vocal advocates like the former vice president of the catastrophic scenario, there continue to be a number of anomalies and defects limiting our ability to predict our climate future. And despite the highly politicized state of the scientific inquiry and what I describe as the climate McCarthyism, I've reached a state of repose over the matter. I mean, as badly politicized as the subject has become, science is an iterative process. And if the skeptics are right, that certain factors behind the warming that we have seen have been underestimated or understudied, or if certain feedback effects that are said to drive future warming are misestimated also, I think in the fullness of time, scientific research and inquiry will come around on this, as we've seen with many past environmental scares, like acid rain. You know, it used to be in the late 70s, many of you may remember this, if you asked Americans what's the most pressing environmental problem, acid rain would show up at the top of the polls. Nowadays, it barely shows up at all when you poll people, because the problem, though not completely wrong, was way overestimated and turned out to be much more minor than we thought when the scientists took a closer and more serious look at it. Suffice it to say that for policymaking purposes today, there are good reasons to conclude that the warming that we may get from this point out is likely to be on the low end of that range and therefore to be a very modest problem. There is a non-trivial risk of very high warming with serious consequences. We do know from the long-term climate record that there have been, over the long history of the Earth's climate the last few hundred thousand years, some very abrupt climate shifts. And we don't know why, still, although we do know it wasn't Fred Flintstone's Ford Explorer. And there are decent reasons for thinking that there might be an intermediate amount of warming, whose effects are hard to estimate decades ahead of time. And so that means that policymakers do need to consider a range of responses in case any of the moderate to severe scenarios should come to pass. Now, right now the problem is that the solitary means of addressing climate change is to embark on a crash reduction of human greenhouse gas emissions because it is said we're reaching a tipping point just a few years away. I have to say I'm enjoying this language. You know, Vice President Gore, James Hansen at NASA, who I've debated a couple times, say that we're within a decade of a tipping point beyond which it'll be too late. And I always like to say, does that mean 10 years from now, come what may, you're going to shut up? I think we know what the answer to that is. I collect this tipping point language, by the way, going back to the 60s and 70s. People like the Secretary General of the UN, U Thant, saying in 1970, we have 10 years to get a handle on these disasters or we're doomed. That was 38 years ago, and we're still here. I did a Nexus search a couple of years ago that I've been updating to look for the occurrences in the newspapers and magazines of the terms climate change and tipping point. In 2001, you saw the use of tipping point and climate change in about 200 stories. Last year, you saw tipping point and climate change in 2,000 media stories. Or as I like to say, to mix book title metaphors, we've now reached a perfect storm of tipping points. And we're letting our cliches do our thinking for us. Well, we need to ask some serious questions about a crash course in greenhouse gas emissions reductions. How feasible and realistic is this? Will it work? And if not, what other possible approaches might be considered? Well, right now, the climate campaigners, as I call them, are saying that the U.S. needs to achieve an 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by the year 2050, 42 years from now. I call this the 80 by 50 target. Both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have endorsed 80 by 50. John McCain's not that far behind. He's calling for a 65% reduction by the year 2050, reprising that old sort of low-budget liberalism of Republicans back in the 50s and 60s. We ought to reflect on what an 80% reduction by the year 2050 means. Ordinarily, this is the point at which I would crank up the PowerPoint slides and go through a blizzard of numbers. But I have lately given up PowerPoint, along with rich, fatty foods. In fact, I even joined PowerPointers Anonymous. The 12-step program's got a problem, though. It starts with a PowerPoint show. You know, I think if Lord Acton were alive today, he'd say power corrupts and PowerPoint corrupts absolutely. So I've given it up. Bear with me as I walk you through some numbers, a few of which I presented in a column in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, some of you may have seen, and a full accounting of which with lots of detailed tables and source notes are in my latest index of leading environmental indicators, which you can also download free from Al Gore's favorite invention. And I'll also recapitulate this analysis after I go through it in a very simple way, in fact, to emulate the way Ronald Reagan used to explain the federal budget. So if you get lost along the way, don't worry. I'll come back and try and wrap it up in a simple way towards the end. The first question you want to begin with is, what is our current inventory of carbon dioxide emissions? There are several greenhouse gases, methane, nitrous oxide, but carbon dioxide is the main one, and that's the one that we will seek to regulate if we do decide to regulate it. And according to the latest inventory of our Department of Energy, in 2006, the U.S. emitted not quite 6 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide. That's about 20 tons per capita, 20 tons for each one of you here in the room and every other American. Now, an 80% reduction in CO2, for diplomatic reasons I won't go into, 1990 is the baseline year we're measuring from. So an 80% reduction from 1990 levels means that in the year 2050, we have to get back to about 1 billion tons of CO2. Now, these are what I like to call MIGO numbers. My eyes glaze over, right? I mean, billions of tons of this and 80% of that. What does it possibly mean? Well, let's work through it this way. When was the last time U.S. carbon dioxide emissions were 1 billion tons? Well, I've gone through the historical data. It took me some time to do it and figure it out. But the answer turns out to be 1910, the tail end of the horse and buggy era. That was the last time we emitted a billion tons from our energy use. In 1910, remember, the U.S. only had 92 million people. In 2050, if the Census Bureau is right, the U.S. will have 420 million people, which means that on a per capita basis, each one of us will have to account for a much lower level of emissions than our great-grandparents did 100 years ago. it begins to suggest the level of the challenge involved. What it means on a per capita level, or per capita basis, is that we can each account for no more than 2.5 tons of carbon dioxide emissions, down from about 20 today. Now, by the way, it's quite likely that our emissions of greenhouse gases or carbon dioxide have never been that low. We probably emitted that much carbon dioxide per person back in 1776 when the only thing we burned was wood and a little bit of whale oil in our lamps. Look around the world today. Are there any nations today that have emissions at 2.5 tons per person? Well, there are a few. They include Haiti, Somalia, Mauritius, Belize, you get the picture, all very desperately poor countries that have no technology. And by the way, poor countries tend to have dismal environmental records overall, right? Talk about that more if you want. If you look at the best wealthy industrialized countries today, the ones with the lowest level of emissions, they are France and Switzerland. And many of you probably know where this is going. France, as many people know, generates 80% of its electricity from nuclear power, which has no greenhouse gas emissions. Switzerland generates 80% from nuclear power or hydropower, and both are compact countries where people don't drive anywhere near as far as Americans and where they don't have to transport their goods as far as we do, since we have a much larger country. France and Switzerland right today emit CO2 at about 6.5 metric tons per capita, 2.5 times higher than the target we're going to have to reach in 2050. To take this a little further, the way the Department of Energy does this, and you can, again, if you're an insomniac, download their reports on greenhouse gas emissions and wade through them like I do. Do I have a great job or what, getting to read these wonderful things? They break down emissions into four major categories. Residential, you know, our houses and apartments and condominiums. Commercial, meaning office buildings and retail and the like. Industrial, our manufacturing sector. And transportation, which means planes, trains, and automobiles. And they apportion electricity consumption to each sector of those four major sectors. Now, at the present time, American households account for 1.2 billion tons of carbon dioxide emissions, 20% higher than the entire national target of the 80 by 50 for the entire nation. And that doesn't count any driving we do. That's just what our houses alone do. So in other words, think of it this way. We could shut down, we could have nobody drive anywhere, shut down all factories in the country, shut down all our commercial and retail and all the rest and never leave our houses, and we'd still be 20% above right now with no population growth, the target we'd have to reach in 2050. If the household sector is to emit no more than its present share of carbon dioxide in the year 2050, the household sector will have to reduce its emissions to about 204 million tons. Well, forget electricity for a moment. Right now, today, the Department of Energy estimates that natural gas use in the residential sector accounts for 237 million tons of carbon dioxide emissions right now, which means that even if you don't turn on a single light for a whole year, we're already over what households will be allowed to emit or the target they would have to meet in the year 2050. And that's before you add 40 million new households. So natural gas is going to have to go or be greatly reduced, right? In electricity use, right now the average residence of the U.S. uses about 10,500 kilowatt hours of electricity a year, and that emits about 11.4 tons of carbon dioxide. Now it's much more, of course, if you're Al Gore or John Edwards and live in a 10,000 square foot house, but that's the average figure for us ordinary citizens. You know, those emissions come from heating and cooling and running appliances and so forth. Now, to meet the target of the 80 by 50, household emissions would have to be cut to no more than about 1.5 tons per year. Now, if we try to do that in our current energy infrastructure, we didn't change the way we generate electric power, it would mean reducing our energy consumption to about 2,500 kilowatt hours per year. That turns out to be not even enough electricity to run the average hot water heater. You can forget your refrigerator, your clothes dryers, and absolutely you have to give up flat-screen TVs, which use about 3 times the electricity of our old cathode ray TVs that we all grew up with. Flat-screen TVs are an environmental no-no if you pay close attention to what they say. So we're now way beyond compact fluorescent light bulbs, energy-efficient Energy Star appliances, and better insulation, blankets around your hot water heaters. The same daunting energy math applies to the other sectors, industrial, commercial, and transportation. In transportation, right now, our cars and trucks use about 180 billion gallons of fuel a year. To meet the 80 by 50 target, you'd have to cut consumption to at least 30 billion gallons of fuel a year. We last consumed 30 billion gallons around the year 1930. So what this means is, unless we have a genuine carbon neutral fuel, and ethanol is not it, sidelight, we'll have to either have cars that get a lot higher mileage, I mean much beyond anything they're talking about Detroit delivering, or we have to drive a whole lot less. To give you an example of how daunting this is, you know, a Toyota Prius, the car beloved of everyone in Hollywood. If you drive a Toyota Prius 10,000 miles a year, its CO2 emissions are 1.8 tons. Puts you two-thirds of the way to the total, if you're one person, to your 2.5 tons per capita. If the entire country drove nothing but Toyota Priuses in the year 2050, maybe the technology will get better, but it's not clear. But if we all drove Toyota Priuses, we'd still overshoot the transportation emissions target by 40%. Well, you can work through these numbers a long way to realize how extraordinary they are. And the clear implication is that we would have to replace virtually the entire fossil fuel energy infrastructure of the country with something that is carbon-free or nearly carbon-free, and we'd have to do that in the space of a generation or a little more than a generation. That, I suggest, is a multi-trillion dollar proposition, and I'll come back to that in just a moment. Natural gas, which is the preferred substitute for coal at the moment, that won't even come close. We can replace every single coal-fired power plant in this country with a natural gas-fired plant, and we'd still be more than two times the target that we'd have to meet in the year 2050 to make the 80 by 50 target. Most environmentalists remain opposed to nuclear power, of course, and do hydropower. This is part of why I say that there's a certain unseriousness about the subject. If this really is, as the Vice President says, the former vice president, the greatest crisis to ever face human civilization, then why would you rule out two technologies in use that are carbon-free? And don't get me started on wind power. It's got lots of problems of its own, but right now I track this. There are environmentalist lawsuits trying to block wind power, proposed wind power installations in Wisconsin, Minnesota, Maryland, Texas, West Virginia, and Virginia. And, then, of course, the most famous one in Nantucket Sound. I'd like to say that you can't build wind power anyplace birds fly or Kennedys live. And it's very unlikely that these renewable technologies, wind, solar, and biomass, can ever make up much more than about 20% of our total electricity supply. So let me recapitulate this in a simple way. I promised I would do this. You know, Ronald Reagan used to, by the way, Ronald Reagan would have banned PowerPoint from the White House if they had it then. I'm quite convinced of that. But he used to illustrate the problem of federal spending in the following way. He'd just hold up his arm and say, look, the problem of federal spending is it's rising like this. And what we need to do is make it rise like this. And he'd just lower his arm a little bit. That was a pretty simple way of explaining what he was trying to do with his fiscal policies. Well, you can illustrate the energy problem in a similar way. If you look at the 30-year projections, or not quite 30 years, our Department of Energy and the European Energy Ministries, they all have projections out to the year 2030. That's as far as they want to go. And they predict energy use and greenhouse gas emissions rising about like this. Now, there are two interesting energy economists at Princeton University, Robert Sokolow and Stephen Pakala, and they've been working on this problem for a few years. And to make a long story very short, they suggest that with a supreme effort, the U.S. might be able to hold its carbon dioxide emissions flat to the year 2050. And one of the estimates of what their suggestions include would be about $6 trillion in capital costs between now and 2030, a pretty large number. So, again, to use Ronald Reagan's old method, the Department of Energy predicts that greenhouse gas emissions with a growing economy and growing population are going to go like this. Sokolow and Pakala say with a supreme effort we might keep them flat. And the climate campaigners and the presidential candidates will say, we're going to go like this. I'm reminded of the old line from T.S. Eliot's poem, The Hollow Men, between the idea and the reality falls the shadow. There's a large shadow here between the ideas and the energy realities that actually confront the country in the next generation. Or to use a language environmentalists find more congenial, this kind of target is unsustainable. I've asked people at our Department of Energy and also the European agencies, what do you think of these projections to try and cut emissions 80% by the year 2050? I said, my guess is you guys close your doors and start giggling. They say, oh, absolutely. I mean, we know this is complete madness, you know, but no one listens to us. We're just the people who run the energy ministries, right? It's often said that we need to have ambitious targets like this. Well, fine, but the 80 by 50 target is the energy equivalent of John F. Kennedy having proposed in 1961 that we should make it our goal to land a man on Mars by 1970, a goal that surely would have been futile, counterproductive, and hugely expensive. The claims that are made on alternative energy sources, you know, I really need to do a study of this. There's another story in the USA Today about an imminent breakthrough in solar power. And there have been a lot of improvements in solar power, and I expect there will be more. But this is one of those, oh, we're going to be competitive with coal-fired electricity in 2 years. I can remember now, I'm almost 50, but I can remember now for all my adult life studying these things, we're always 10 years away from, you know, biofuels, from practical solar power, all the other gizmos. And usually these are press releases to try and gin up investment interests. And that's fine. I mean, that's the way the world works. But I suspect 10 years from now, we'll still be 10 years away from some of these promised breakthroughs. This is why I say that most of these technologies simply don't match up to the scale of the energy required or are not cost competitive in their current form. And that's why I say our discourse on this issue is fundamentally unserious. We're not going to divert the immense amount of investment capital contemplated by the 80 by 50 target. It will collapse of its own weight. And someone ought to put these questions in rather pointed form to our candidates and not let them slide by on glittering generalities. Well, now, is there an alternative approach in the event of the worst-case scenario coming to pass? It's some decades down the road. I think there is. And you're going to be hearing more about it, I think, fairly soon. And it goes by the ungainly name of geoengineering. The best way to explain it is as follows, I think. We've long known that fine particles and ash thrown up by volcano eruptions cool the atmosphere. And if you cast your mind back to 1991-92, we had the eruption of Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines, which was the largest volcano eruption in many decades. And it was the first eruption of a volcano where we had all our Earth observation satellites up looking at it, gathering reams of data that we could look at. And in the aftermath of Pinatubo, some of you may remember, planetary temperatures were actually lowered about 1 degree Fahrenheit for about 18 months. So the question, which was actually thought about at the time and is now being revisited, is could humans mimic the climate effects of volcanoes by deliberately injecting fine particles high in the atmosphere, or other similar sorts of ideas? Let's say it's not a new idea. The National Academy of Sciences looked at this in the early 90s and thought, yeah, you could do it, but it'd be too expensive. The last several years, the idea has been coming back, and people say, well, it might be expensive on the order of a few billion dollars a year, but it's several orders of magnitude less expensive than the crash programs to reduce greenhouse gas emissions that I just ran through. However, the idea has been almost taboo in climate science circles. And again, this is politics and not science talking. The best example of this is one of the leading journals in climate science called Climatic Change. Back in 2006, had an article submitted for publication by Paul Crutzen. Paul Crutzen won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry back in the 1980s for his work on the ozone hole. It was some of the most important work leading to the Montreal Protocol phasing out chlorofluorocarbons that were thought to be contributing to the erosion of the ozone hole. And he had written an article saying we ought to think about methods and practicalities of injecting particulates high in the atmosphere. He said it ought to be pretty simple. You could do it. It would only need about 1 million tons a year, which isn't very much. It'd be at a high altitude, so it wouldn't generate acid rain. Some of the practicalities of doing it would include either high-altitude airplanes, large blimps, or even, he suggested, you could take the old battleship New Jersey out of mothballs and use its 16-inch guns to shoot shells up. Now, what happened to his article is fascinating. It passed through peer review at the journal, whereupon repeatedly scientists and editors of the magazine said we shouldn't publish this article. And there was a heated argument about it. And finally, the editor of the journal asked Ralph Cicerone, who was the president of the National Academy of Sciences, to intervene and try and broker some kind of deal. So they eventually published the article. Remember, it's an article that passed peer review, and people still said it should not be published because it was politically or I say, environmentally incorrect. And Ralph Cicerone wrote this in his editor's note. Various individuals have opposed the publication of Crutzen's paper, even after peer review and revisions, for various and sincere reasons that are not wholly scientific. I emphasize that last part. People opposed the article for reasons that were not scientific. And they published four articles rebutting Crutzen's article, saying, well, it might be something to it, but we really shouldn't think about this, right? It's, you know, the only thing we can do is emissions reductions. Well, I think that this kind of environmental correctness ought to be genuinely disturbing. It shouldn't be a reason to prevent research. There are a number of difficulties with the idea of geoengineering. It doesn't solve all climate-related problems. There are some problems of diplomacy that immediately come to mind. Who sets the world's thermostat? Do Russia and Canada really want their northern reaches to cool off again? They're the big winners of a warmer world, by the way. On the other hand, since anyone could do this, do we want to leave it to China to decide in 15 or 20 years? They've got a growing space program. They might decide, we don't want to get with an emissions reductions program. We'll just shoot off some sulfur rockets of our own. Wouldn't it be in the interest of the United States to be in the lead of something like this? Well, I'll conclude with this. I think you're going to hear a lot more about geoengineering because even the alarmist scientists are starting to realize some of the daunting economics and practical realities I was running through a few minutes ago, and they're starting to say maybe geoengineering is the fallback idea we need to think seriously about and begin some research on. I have a couple of predictions, and then I'll take questions. I think that this issue is going to look very different 20 years from now. Could be wrong, but my hunch is, and I've been following these kinds of issues for a long time now and studying our history, is that once again we have overestimated an environmental problem. And like past environmental scares like acid rain I mentioned a few minutes ago, we're going to realize that we've overestimated the problem. Not that it was wholly wrong, but overestimated. And I also think that environmentalists at some point are going to realize down the road that this was an issue that ate them alive. Having placed all their eggs in this basket, they have neglected serious thought and work on genuine problems that defy easy solution, like species extinction and habitat loss around the world, especially in the developing world. We have been through, in recent years, the internet bubble, and of course the housing bubble we're still working our way out of now, and I think we're at the apex of the climate change bubble. Now, I don't think it will burst, but I think it will deflate and may start deflating fairly soon. And the problem is that Congress does seem determined to pass the climate policy equivalent of Sarbanes-Oxley. Something, a lot of you from companies here will, you know, understand the problem immediately. Something that's very costly and intrusive and generates very modest or negligible results. So that's the political hazard of the moment. But with that, I will stop and look forward to your questions. Thank you.
If 80 and 50 or 50 and 80 is unrealistic, then what is realistic? How do you see us getting there, and what's the time frame?
President Bush here a couple weeks ago gave a speech where he set as a goal stopping the growth of our emissions by the year 2025. And, of course, he was greeted by a universal chorus of raspberries from the New York Times and all the environmentalists saying too little, too late. And that's what I wrote in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, is at least it has the virtue of possibly being realistic. It's true in my remarks I dumped on a lot of, renewable energy technologies and wind and the things that we're looking at right now. There's a lot of ferment right now about concentrated solar, which instead of the old photovoltaics is actually essentially driving a steam generator with solar power and storing liquid sodium and all kinds of fancy things. And there's some experimental pilot projects. You never want to say never. Physicist at NYU, Marty Hofert, who writes some interesting thoughts on this subject in Science Magazine and elsewhere, likes to make the point that between the Wright brothers' first flight at Kitty Hawk and Neil Armstrong stepping off onto the moon was, 66 years. It's not that long. It's longer than we're talking about getting to 2050 from here. So there may be some energy breakthroughs that would change everything. But right now, the physics of it look pretty difficult. The laws of thermodynamics are pretty daunting. And there's a reason that fossil fuels have outcompeted everything else. It's what energy people call energy density. A lump of coal, barrel of oil, cubic foot of natural gas packs a lot of energy in a concentrated way, and those fuels are transportable, too, which is a problem with wind power and solar is they're not transportable. What's realistic is right now we the U.S., by the way, it turns out, has the best record in greenhouse gas emissions control in the last decade. The Europeans talk a great game. We're actually the ones performing. Our greenhouse gas emissions actually went down in 2006 on an absolute level, while European ones are going back up again after their peculiarities of the 90s. Our record on energy efficiency is actually pretty good. The reason our energy consumption keeps going up is that our population and our economy grow faster than our rate of efficiency gains. So net consumption continues to go up. So until someone can invent some quote-unquote magic bullets, these steep reduction targets are going to continue to be unrealistic and unachievable almost at any price.
If these goals are unachievable through public policy, is there anything at all that you think individuals can do to make a difference?
Well, I long ago went to a compact fluorescent light bulbs, not so much to save money as I hate changing light bulbs. It's just one of those inefficiencies of light, and I hate climbing on the ladder and all the rest of that. And the CFLs last a long time. Even if everyone does all those, if everybody does all the conservation tips that they're recommended to do, and there's no reason not to, our energy consumption line goes from something like that to something like that. It knocks it down a few degrees, and that's fine. But we've been doing that, by the way. Here's the thing about Americans. One way I illustrate this is a lot of people go into McDonald's and order the Diet Coke so they can order the supersized fries. Right? I'm saving those calories. I'll lose those saved calories. I'll have supersized fry or the brownie for dessert. We do that with energy. The average new home in America is now more than a third larger than the average new home in 1970, but uses the same amount of electricity because we have more efficient appliances, better insulation. But instead of pocketing those efficiency gains, we buy the flat-screen TV or two of them. Or what I noticed in a lot of model homes in recent years is, we have the refrigerators that use half the amount of power, but a lot of homes these days, new homes, have two refrigerators. The average American sees that yellow sticker on the fridge that says it'll cost you half what your previous one did. The average American says, great, I keep twice as much beer cold for football on Sunday. That's the way we live. That's sort of the reality of it. So, look, I'm not one of these who poo-poos energy efficiency and conservation, but it doesn't get you very far down the field. It's because of the way we live. We need to have revolutions in energy technology to really change the game in a fundamental way.
If we are to take nuclear power seriously, what do we do with the waste and the problem of terrorists?
The first thing we'd probably do is reprocess or recycle our fuel. That's what everybody else in the world does except us. And when you do that, you have a tiny amount of waste, and that becomes much more manageable. The reason, and that relates to the second question, the reason we resisted reprocessing and recycling fuel is that generates a lot of the weapons-grade fissile material we've worried about for proliferation purposes. The problem is that nobody followed us. We'd hope the whole world would follow us on and not recycle and reprocess their fuel, but for a variety of reasons, the world didn't. So that genie's out of the bottle, and that problem now persists whether we do any more with nuclear power or not. I don't want to sort of shove that and trivialize that problem, but that's a very serious problem. But we've got that problem anyway, no matter what we do with nuclear power in this country. And I'm going to have to leave that to some other speaker to address how we – not my department, as they say. They do that downstairs from me at AEI.
We're on the verge of spending, I think it says, $2 trillion on the Iraq war.
Yeah.
If we spent that much on environmental problems, phasing out fossil fuels, would we be making progress?
You'd make maybe a third of the progress, which means you might get a 30% reduction by 2050 instead of 80%. That's if those estimates are right on Sokolow and Pakal approach, which, who knows? The truth is we don't know what things like concentrated solar electricity generation will really cost. I did do this estimate. I looked at current construction costs for natural gas power and just did a simple back-of-the-envelope calculation, what would it cost today to replace all our coal plants with natural gas plants? And the low-end figure I got was about $1.2 trillion. And if you did that and other things, you'd still only get about halfway to your 80 by 50 goal in the best case. And that leaves aside the problem of where you're going to get all that natural gas from. So that's a decent question. It's also a sort of a separate question. I think nobody likes how much we've spent on this war. We'll stop there.
Do you think Indiana has a coal problem? If so, what should we do about it?
Well, a coal problem. Let me put it to you this way. The figure is you can look up under the Department of Energy statistics the coefficients, the emissions coefficients. And for the nation as a whole, I think the figure is 1.3 pounds of carbon dioxide for every kilowatt hour. I think that's I'm not sure that's the right electricity. It's 1.3 pounds per X amount of electricity. You break it down state by state, Indiana's about twice that. Indiana's about 2.4 pounds of CO2 for the same, because of much higher use of coal here than other states. Washington State, Oregon, California, which have no coal power plants, their coefficients are much, much lower. So what that means is if you pass Lieberman, Warner, or any other kind of climate policy in Washington that targets coal, that means Indiana will have a disproportionate share of the costs on ratepayers and so forth. If you define coal as a problem, and that's fine. Just remember, if you have more coal than other states, you're going to end up getting a disproportionate share of the cost of whatever national policy is used on coal. Whether it's emissions trading, which I didn't talk about because that's really wonky and boring, or carbon sequestration. We try and grab it out of the air and stick it in the ground or something, which is looking to be very expensive and difficult to do. Either way, you'll have to pay for a lot if we're going to get rid of coal. I'll just add this. All this talk these days about energy independence, long subject, could be subject for another complete speech, but the number one priority of our climate policy is to de-emphasize the use of the energy source we have in the most abundance here at home. And if you're going to increase natural gas significantly, we're going to have to import a lot of it. And guess who we import it from? Okay.
You've answered a lot of the questions in your various remarks. I have several questions that I'm trying to knit together because you've been linked with, in some people's minds, the Carter presidency, Nancy Pelosi, and Newt Gingrich, and other figures. And one asks, do you get death threats from Al Gore devotees, and do you have adequate security?
Well, let me say a couple things here. I got into environmental issues kind of by accident in graduate school. I went to graduate school to study political science and history, but it was in L.A., and I grew up with smog and ended up studying it. One thing led to another. I try to limit – so I have an academic interest in broad-spectrum political science issues, which is why I write on presidents and traditional American government topics. I try to limit my work on the environment, I like to say, to no more than half my time. Otherwise, I would surely die from self-inflicted wounds before old age. I get a lot of nasty mail. Down the hall from me at AEI is a lady I'm sure many of you heard of, is Ayaan Hirsi Ali. She's the Somali woman who had the film made her by that Dutch filmmaker Theo van Gogh, who was stabbed by... Well, she's down the hall from me at AEI, and she has private security. A couple of really beefy guys who, in my mind, are a lot more intimidating than the Secret Service guys that Lynn Cheney occasionally brings with her to the office when she comes. So I stick close to her. That's how I...
We can debate these issues till the cows come home. I'm more interested in finding a suite of solutions to control climate change. What do you see besides geothermal engineering that might be put together to form the solutions?
Well, there's the old joke, of the two economists walking down the street. And the one says, look, there's a $10 bill on the ground. And the other economist says, no, it can't be a $10 bill. If it were a $10 bill on the ground, someone would have grabbed it by now. Right, it's the way economists think, right? Well, that sort of comes to mind in this. I mean, you know, there aren't any magic bullets right now, and even some of the speculative things look difficult, although, you know, I mean, I'm sort of an optimist and think that we may get surprised here in a positive way down the road in a few years. There's a lot of money, a lot of venture capital going into this in Silicon Valley. And, you know, there's a lot of hope in Silicon Valley that they can do in energy what they did with the Internet and high tech 10 years ago. Of course, some of that, remember, didn't work out very well, but nonetheless, we could... You know, there is some reason that there's an awful lot of attention and thought going into this. I do think we need to spend a lot more on basic energy research from the government level because the scale of certain things is beyond what venture capital and private companies will do. There's some difficulties with that because the Congress always likes to spend money on things in their district and tend to pick winners. That's how we got the ethanol debacle. And so that's a tricky thing to try and confine and not make it become a pork barrel project. But still, there's a good case to be made for more intensive energy research. I think there'll be a broad spectrum of things that are going to come along. I'd add also that when you talk about the developing world, see, one of the things the Indians said to Vice President Gore at Kyoto 10 years ago when the Kyoto Treaty was clearly heading for trouble is they said, look, the Vice President asked them, won't you please come into this treaty in some form, make some pledge to join an emissions cap down the road in the second round 10, 15 years from now? And the Indians gave them a flat no. And what they said was, look, you people in America and Europe got wealthy on fossil fuels, and now you're telling us that we can't? And they said to him, when we're as wealthy as you are in 50 or 75 years, then come talk to us about emissions caps. Well, so one question you want to ask for the developing world is India and other developing countries like that, are they better off through economic development that gives them the resources to afford more expensive energy technologies? Because, by the way, one problem this whole game is that we might be able to afford to spend $6 trillion. I mean, probably not, but, you know, we are a wealthy country and you can spend out wasting $2 billion on the Iraq war. But India and China and South Korea and Brazil, they can't afford those kinds of bills for energy technology. And unless those countries go along, we can spend all of our money on it, and it will make negligible difference in the standard theory of global warming. So one of the things that has to happen is other countries have got to get wealthy, too, if they're going to be able to afford more exotic and expensive energy technologies. So one thing I'd say is we need to encourage economic growth, which in all the usual ways you would do that for the rest of the world.
That was Dr. Stephen Hayward. He spoke to the Economic Club of Indiana April 29th. Hayward is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Dr. Philip Powell is a professor of business economics and public policy at the Indiana University Kelly School of Business. Powell talks about the effects climate change has had on economics, specifically in Indiana.
There's a lot of emotion on this issue, and it's not a black and white issue. I don't typically run around in environmentalist circles. Climate change, I think, is going to be gradual. I think you have to – the news media likes to overblow these very sort of dramatic changes. But the reality is that if you put more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it's going to increase the temperature. And certainly you might see – fast change at the polar regions, especially the North Pole. But as far as Hoosiers go and here in Indiana, it'll be gradual. I mean, you'll see the sort of – and you're already starting to see this in the United States. You start to see what was – plants PC sort of shift north and this type of thing. I think, you know, the media love to hype everything. Everything's a disaster waiting to happen. That's what increases ratings. If you look at the science, look at the models, there's going to be change. It's going to be gradual, and we're going to have to face it. And there'll probably be some melting, but it's going to be very incremental and very gradual. The only way we're going to change, or the only way we're going to, as a society, as Hoosiers, the only way we're going to reduce our output of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is to change the economic incentives. And we have to make carbon expensive. We have to have a tax. And so if you look at now, there's a lot of people responding to these high gas prices. Now, the reason that gas price is high is because the dollar's weak. It's not because we have a shortage of oil. But all of a sudden, we're more sensitized. We have an incentive to be better stewards of our resources. So I think that if we're going to actually the bottom line is that we need to reduce carbon emissions. And the only way to do that is to impose a cost both on firms and on individuals. And if there's a cost, then they're gonna have an incentive to change their ways, whether it's converting more quickly to better technologies, finding more efficient ways to get the job done. But that's the only way we're going to reduce carbon emissions. So while higher taxes certainly can generate short-term pain in terms of the adjustment process, if we're really going to address this issue, we've got to put a price on carbon, and you either do that through a tax or you do it through a trading scheme. I mean, we've got to make this an economic issue. And even if you look at McCain, the Republican who's running, I mean, even George Bush, they're taking global climate change seriously. And the science is overwhelming. I mean, this is something that we need to look at. The world's not going to end tomorrow, but we need to start to change the incentives. Now, another sort of second best approach is, instead of taxing carbon, is to subsidize technological change. So the tax write-offs that we see for hybrid cars, I would like to see, you know how we have the National Institute of Health, which gives these research grants to academic institutions to sort of improve medicine. I would love to see an equivalent for environmental change or for really energy change and fund it at the same level. That might be a softer approach instead of taxing people, which I know is very unpopular. Economic opportunity in any economy is always on the cutting edge of technology. Right now, the prices, gas prices are going up, energy prices are going up, but they're not high enough to really send us into overdrive in terms of investing in new R&D. That's why a lot of folks argue for the government subsidies. Now, will that create new jobs? Absolutely. But you have to understand, our economy is really already fully employed right now. Our unemployment rate is 5.2%. So it will create new jobs, but in order for it to be healthy for economic activity, we've got to make sure that the government doesn't over-subsidize it so that we don't create artificial growth that can't sustain itself in a free market. So a little bit of push from the government, whether it's the state government or the federal government, can certainly be good, but we have to make sure, and it will create jobs, but we have to make sure that the government stays out of the private sector's way to sort of figure out how to answer the change, the need for new technology. So it does create new jobs, but again, we have to realize that just because when the government spends money, it creates new jobs, but the best types of jobs are those jobs that sustain themselves when the government subsidies go away. Can we ultimately reduce greenhouse gases? Absolutely. Again, it comes down to the incentives. If environmental policy simply becomes this whole issue of sort of moral suasion and command and control policy initiatives by the government, you'll get this political polarization that won't get anything done. You'll get gridlock. We need to follow the European example, where you either have a trading scheme where you allow people to pollute if they have a permit, but the market sets the price for those permits, mm-hmm. or you tax it, mm-hmm. and then sort of let the free market determine how best to achieve those reductions. Mm-hmm. Again, bottom line, we're not going to reduce carbon emissions until we put a price on it. Mm-hmm. And the higher the price, the quicker the change will occur. Yeah. That's just the law of supply and demand. First of all, as a society, we have to accept the fact that carbon emissions impose a cost on society, whether it be this generation or future generations. And a lot of folks will argue, and I'm one of them, that we have an ethical responsibility to sort of make sure that our children inherit an environment that at least can support their own level of economic activity, hopefully a higher level of prosperity.
Philip Powell is the Clinical Associate Professor of Business Economics and Public Policy at the Indiana University Kelly School of Business. You've been listening to the Indiana Public Broadcasting Station's presentation of the Economic Club of Indiana. The guest speaker was American Enterprise Institute scholar and writer Dr. Stephen Hayward. On May 9th, expert economist and syndicated columnist Walter Williams talks to the club about economics and politics. Walter Williams is an expert economist with over 150 articles published, and he's also the author of 6 books. He is an occasional guest host on the Rush Limbaugh Show. Be sure to join us next month for the IPBS broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana.
ProLiance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.